And you learn pretty quick that your mindset has to change when you start masters. You know, the word keeps coming to mind is adaptability. You know, you need to really change really quickly and go, okay, I've gone through two doors now. I'm opening another one, and I've been pushed through, and I need to sort of unlearn some of this stuff, start again with a fresh attitude and an open mindset.
Okay, life can be crazy. You're feeling like you're sinking. Just trying to find a meaning. It's time for better thinking. Yeah, better thinking. Time to tune in. Let's go.
This episode, I talk with Glenn Tanner, who's an early career psychologist. We talk about how his journey was in getting into psychology, what his journey was like studying psychology, and what it's been like since graduating. Lots of discussion around self-care and how to get through. So if you are going through the master's program or a 4+2, if you're a psychologist, you'll really enjoy this one in particular. And please also remember, if you are looking for a position, if you're close to graduating or you're in that early career stage, give me a call. You can make contact through strategicpsychology.com.au/careers. Or go to nashnaglick.com.
Today on Better Thinking Podcast, I've got Glenn Tanner, who's a ClinPsych registrar, and he's in effect an early career psychologist, meaning he's graduated last year. And the reason for having him on is to find out a little bit about what it's like, the journey through becoming a psychologist, you know, what that kind of looks like from a personal experience, because there's a lot of people out there that have, you know, been interested to hear about this topic because there's many of us going through, or there's many of us thinking about going through, and what it's like in these earlier years. So I want to say a big thank you and welcome to Glenn.
Hi, Nash. Thanks for having me on the show.
So let's just roll in, you know, get started and talk about maybe how you got into psychology in the first place. I find this always interesting, and whenever I do recruiting, my first question is, you know, how did you get into psychology? I'm just fascinated, interested about that, because there's always a story.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one I get asked a lot as well. So I guess mine's quite an unusual story. I was involved in wine manufacturing and sales in the Hunter Valley. And I suppose whilst it was a really good life, like I enjoyed it, there was a lot of good about the life. You know, it was quite a relaxed life. There was something missing, you know, and I just thought somewhere underneath it all, there was just something missing. And it was around about the age of 28, I had a family member who became quite ill, and she required, you know, she went and saw a psychologist. And just getting to know that psychologist, you know, just week in, week out, and just getting to see like how much it was helping that particular family member, I just sort of thought, well, look, I'm searching for something more substantial, and I think that's probably a good way to go. So
did you meet that psychologist?
I did.
Yeah, wow. Well, what was that like in terms of meeting a psychologist, being, I suppose, you know, the loved one of someone going through a particularly hard time?
Yeah, look, I suppose you had your sort of presuppositions about that, and I was a little bit anxious. And I guess I was a little bit reluctant at first, and she invited me into the session, and after about the second or third session, I just got to, I just become much more comfortable, much more relaxed about seeing the psychologist. And it just sort of made me realize just how important the role is. And it was a wonderful, very important, rewarding experience, and life-changing.
Yeah, one of my I can't actually remember who it was, but one of my lecturers, or maybe even several lecturers at university, suggested to not only me but the whole class, it's important to take the role of the other chair, and to go in and spend a bit of time in the client's chair rather than therapist's chair, to give us a little bit more breadth and understanding. And I personally have done that myself, to go out and try and experience what's on the other end. And I tell you what, there's always something to talk about, isn't there?
Indeed there is. And I think that's really good advice that you've been given. And look, I've found myself on the other side, on the other chair, I suppose, quite a fair bit over the last sort of 6-7 years. And even when we have our supervision, you know, we're on the other side there. So
absolutely.
And it does, it helps you, because the journey itself, just going through the undergraduate program, the honors program, then the master's, can be quite stressful, you know. So just having that support there is just so important. And then when you go and see someone while you're going through the program, you're also getting an education as well. So you're also picking up little tips and strategies, and you're like, oh, that's how you should interact. And that's what rapport building looks like in practical application. It's been wonderful. And I think that, if anyone doing the undergraduate honours or master's is, not doing too well, if they're finding a little bit difficult, which it is a difficult program, I couldn't recommend going to see someone enough. I think it's incredibly beneficial. Definitely.
Is it still the stigma that kind of keeps us away? What do you think? Because it's kind of scary, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of stigma there, and it's quite unfortunate. And considering how far we've come, it's 2019, and we're so progressive, as a society, particularly Australia, in a lot of ways. But in mental health, we're getting better, but it's not quite there. And I've just been doing some work with some minors. So working in the Hunter Valley, going up to educate minors on the EAP program. And it's quite obvious that the stigma's there. And part of what I've been doing is going, meeting with them individually, and giving them the opportunity to speak about some of the issues they're not, perhaps they're not comfortable speaking about amongst their workmates, to raising an issue with supervisor. It's just sort of breaking down that stigma, which I think is really important.
Yeah, it's kind of like we're still in the dark ages, right? Maybe it's just a part of human nature in terms of when we're vulnerable, it's frightening to put the vulnerability out there. And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
To do that almost creates a sense of, weakness or fear. Will I be rejected for this? How will people judge me? And hence why, psychology has to have and maintain really strongly confidentiality, and make sure that privacy is at the utmost level for people to go in and say, I can do this privately, because it's scary. What happens if it comes out? I'll be thrown out and abandoned and ridiculed and laughed at and so on.
Look, that's exactly right, and that's why confidentiality is so important, and it's so important to build that initial rapport and make sure that therapeutic alliance is just so tight, because it's when people feel, when they feel safe, that's when the walls come down. And it's just taking that first step. And going back to what you were asking about before, when I first saw a psychologist, I had all these presuppositions and preconceived notions, and I was, when I was on my way to see the psychologist, I was very anxious, and I remember thinking, I'm not going to let them break me. I'm not going to cry, of course I cried like a baby.
Is that what you mean by break me, the crying?
Yeah, perhaps, but I guess it's just letting down those walls. So for me, that was important, is having that emotional release, and I was trying to sort of hold on to that. And that's what I was fearing the most, So that's how it was for me. But for other people, it might be other things, And just sort of, just talking about their problems is a particular issue for some people, and they're just not used to it. And the therapeutic environment is quite unique. You don't usually get an environment where you can just talk to a friend or a family member or a colleague and get that level of engagement. And just that, with those active listening skills that we're taught, are just so powerful. So, it's making sure that that clients feel safe, that they feel secure, that they can come in, have a chat, and they can just slowly break down some of the walls and some of the stigma.
Yeah, wow, wow. And how did you go about, transitioning from, the winery world, which sounds pretty damn appealing when you explain it in the way that you did, to taking that leap, because I'm assuming, you got it. There's a fair bit to kind of let go of, income or, efforts, Friday, Saturday nights, weekends, relationships, friendships, socialization, your other dreams, what was it that kind of was so compelling for you to, jump in the deep end? Because there's a huge investment.
Indeed it is. It's a really good question. I think that a lot of mature age students ask themselves this question. So I was 28. I loved the wine industry. It was great. It was quite glamorous. So, there was a lot of sampling of wine and wine education. So it had its appeal.
Were there times where it wasn't sampling?
May have indulged occasionally, guilty as charged. But so it was really quite a glamorous lifestyle. And, that everyone you met was happy. They were, somewhat a little bit tipsy as well occasionally. Sure. So it was every customer who came through the door were just happy. They were at their best. You were giving them free wine. So there was nothing to be sad about. And it was a wonderful, wonderful life. But as I said before, there was just something missing. And I think my interactions with, a family member getting sick and my interactions with a psychologist were just sort of enough just to push me over the edge and go seeking something a little bit more substantial. I thought about two avenues actually at the time. I thought, well, I really like law. So I sort of enrolled in the law degree, and at the same time I enrolled in a psychology degree, and I thought, well, look, I'll just try both of them for 6 months and see which one I like the most, and whatever I get the better grades out, I'll go with that particular course. And it turned out that it was psychology. I was just getting really fascinated by learning about all those little theories and principles and learning about Freud and Jung, and it was just fascinating. And the grades were much better in psychology than law. So I thought that's probably the way I'll go, which is what I was feeling in my heart anyway. So it was just sort of reaffirming that. However, I guess no one really told me that, nothing could really prepare me for how different and how unique the psychological journey could be. I suppose the 3 years undergraduate, then the honors year, then the master's, and just maintaining those grades or high standards sort of distinction or HD throughout your undergraduate to get into honors, and then it's quite competitive. It sort of bottlenecks quite significantly, and then again to master's. So it's a really full on investment, and it does take its toll. So I had to say goodbye to money. I had to say goodbye to drinking fine wine. So I was now, couldn't afford those Penfolds. I think it was more a bottle from Aldi every fortnight or something like that. and it's a huge, huge sacrifice and a huge change and shock to the system, coming from winemaker, wine sales, good income, able to go on holidays, put money in the bank, to just saying, putting all that aside, stopping that, and then starting on a different journey. It was a huge, huge shock. Yeah,
that's massive. That I'm sure that's going to resonate for a lot of people, because we don't often think about what's the cost of investment. That the cost isn't just the time; it's what you've given up during that time. Whether it be, the cost of the income, which we can fairly easily go out and quantify, but there's a difference between the cost of now buying a different bottle of wine, because it's not really about, the wine's the experience of how you now go out and live life. That a lot of these luxuries we drop off. You've actually got to think about this, finances. It becomes a financial pressure. You know, it's something that you carry in your mind, you worry about. You know, I know, you know, for myself, without my parents, there is no way in the world I would have been able to get through, because, you know, they homed me. You know, that housing came from somewhere, certainly not from me. I did for a period, but come Masters, it was just impossible for me to do, you know, because I could no longer work 24 hours, you know, a week and do a full-time load. I just couldn't achieve it any further. So there's a huge investment, but it's important to, you know, give voice to that, because it's not really well known. You just don't know until you're there.
That's exactly right. You know, and I could not never have known, you know, there's no real way of preparing yourself for something like that. It's a huge undertaking. To anyone listening to this who's thinking about, you know, doing the clinical master's program, or, you know, I encourage you to do so. It's a very rewarding, wonderful experience. You know, the occupation's wonderful. You know, I absolutely love my job, but, you know, I'd say to them this, you know, just, you know, it's what you hit on, really. You know, it's making sure that, you know, you've got, you know, those basics in order. So making sure you've got a place to stay, making sure, you know, you've got an income, and it needs to be a reliable income, because you don't want an added stress or a pressure when you're doing a clinical master's program. It's quite, you know, it can be quite stressful in itself. You know, you're learning at an accelerated rate. So a little bit of planning before you go into it goes a long way. Yeah. And self-care, you know, self-care is important. When you don't have those luxuries, when you don't have, you know, the money coming in anymore, when you're on your own, when you're studying sometimes 50 hours a week, you've got to be kind to yourself. And that might be, you know, keeping, you know, eating well, you know, exercising regularly, practicing what you preach, and doing some meditation.
I was going to ask you, how did you go with that? Because I know that traditionally, you know, students don't do that well. And reflecting back for me, self-care was not really a part of my vocabulary back then. It was, you know, burn the candle at both ends. And if you get into a sticky situation, burn it in the middle.
Yeah, look, I think there's a big difference between Glenn 5 years ago and Glenn now. You know, I sort of practice what I preach a little bit more. But I suppose it is difficult, you know, because we can be an anxious bunch, you know, psychologists, and I suppose you have to be quite conscientious and studious to do what you do to get, you know, an honours degree, to get a second or first class honours degree, to, you know, to be able to be organised to do a master's degree at a very high level, and then liaise with supervisors, and not just clinical supervisors, but also your thesis supervisor. So you need to be quite organised, conscientious, and quite driven. And we know that has a good side to it. You know, it gets things done. You also need to be careful that you're being kind to yourself, you're being compassionate. So, yeah, I think it was I slowly got it that, you know, self-care was really important. I think it hit home my sixth year. I just thought, well, if I don't get onto this now, I'm not going to make it through. The year's just too hard. So,
yeah. What was your journey through the passage into honours and the passage then across to master, because each of those times, you know, there's effectively an assessment as to whether you go through to the next round. I mean, that's kind of how it's built at the moment, that there's a certain number of honours students that each university will take into the course, you know, because they can't have an open numbers, and then obviously it becomes smaller again to, you know, who can go into the master's program. How did you go, and how did you fare in going through those? Was it a stressful process? Was it something that, you know, you felt fairly confident about? How did it go?
I was very stressed. I was very stressed. I was very conscious of you know, just how it was becoming more narrow and more narrow at each step. So it felt like, you know, in my first year, it seemed like there was thousands of students, you know, and there must have been, I don't know, maybe 1,000 at my uni doing year one. Then year two, I'd look to my left and look to my right, and I'd think, where are people? People are just dropping off. Okay, this must be hard. And then by third year, the group was very small and intimate. And then honours, it was sort of 35 people. And then masters, it was about 30. But
30 each, for masters.
30 for
masters. Well, ours dropped down to about 6. It was probably about 35 for the honours. I did a post-grad because my marks weren't up to spec, but I squeezed through somehow. But then, you know, going into masters from both the honours and the post-grad went down to, I think fairly clearly it was 6, you know, but I imagine it changes all the time and it fluctuates depending on what the university can handle and so on and so forth.
Yeah, look, that's quite a small number. I mean, that's which university was that?
That was at Uni of Canberra.
Okay, yeah. I went to Western Sydney University, and I know that there were smaller cohorts. I think the Australian Catholic University had quite a small I went for the interview there, which was really stressful. And I think, don't quote me on this, but I think they said they were accepting something like 10 people. So similar, quite a small amount. Yeah.
What was the interview like? What sort of questions did they ask? What were they looking for? You know, kind of reflecting back.
Yeah, look, reflecting back, I get it. I get it now. And I think they were after someone who had grit, you know, and they the questions were, I can't really remember. Perhaps I've blocked it out on purpose. I'm not too sure. But I remember there was quite a lot of questions, and they were geared. They were trying to just, you know, make sure that I was the right person for the program, you know. And looking back, I see why, because the program was difficult, and I suppose, you know, students need to have a certain amount of grit. There were questions that were, I think, about you know, self-care. So that was really important. You know, they were sort of trying to make sure they got students in who prioritized self-care, who had things in place to be able to do the course practically, because it's 2 years out of your life and it's very full on. So, they were just, you know, they were looking after our well-being, but they were just trying to make sure that we were going to get through the course in one piece. So a lot of sort of those sorts of questions.
That's a really interesting observation, because I recall from my journey through, probably the only question that I really recall was, what are you going to do if you don't get in? You know, so almost kind of alluding to, you know, you need to have some other preparations. And this one sticks out in my mind because I think I potentially secured the position through my answer, which was, then I'll just get in elsewhere. You know, if you guys don't take me, ANU will. And if ANU doesn't, then Bathurst will. And if Bathurst doesn't, somewhere in Perth will. And if somewhere in Perth doesn't, then there'll be another city. And if they don't, if Australia can't, I'll find it elsewhere. I'll go international. I am becoming a psychologist, you know, effectively, whether you like it or not, I'm getting in. Just might not be at this uni. So that was my approach. Because I'd committed from first year through knowing that that's what I'm doing, because I, you know, very much like yourself, put another career aside to start this new one. I think grit, you know, that word of, you know, hard work, you know, I often talk about, you know, hustling, you know, just grinding is another word, you know, it's got to be part of it.
Absolutely. Look, I think you gave the exact right response, you know, and I think you demonstrated in the response you gave, you demonstrated grit, determination, willpower. And these are so important. You know, it's good to develop great habits. You know, I developed a lot of really habits that were non-negotiable habits. You know, these were studying for certain times in the day, allowing myself a little bit of a break, but It was a several hours per day studying, dedicated to learning more. And those habits got me through. They got me through the practical application. But it's the grit that really got me up in the morning, you know, and the resilience. Because, you know, going from honours or even undergraduate, well, if you're getting to honours, then you're probably a pretty good student. So you're probably used to getting really good marks. And it's a little bit of a shock when you get to masters and you sort of get your first assignment back and it's like, well, what's this? A credit? What's that? You know, my world's falling down. So it's a little bit of a shock to the system instantly, which I think looking back in hindsight was just the shock you needed. So yeah.
It's almost like it's designed to, you know, grab you by the shirt and kind of give you a shake of saying, you know, this isn't going to be a walk in the park. You've got to really apply yourself because there's going to be some intensive learning in these, you know, couple of years, and we're going to throw a lot at you, more than just coursework. You know, you're going to be doing placement on top of coursework, which will be 1,000 hours. You're going to be also doing a thesis, which is going to be, you know, countless words. You know, each of those need to have deadlines and you know, considerable work because they're not straightforward. It's not just writing an essay. You've got to go out and do, you know, methodology, data collection, analysis, so on and so forth. Yeah, it's a real big piece of work that, you know, if you don't get that shake, you know, you're probably underprepared. So it's a good... potentially it's a good formula to, you know, knock everyone about and say, wake up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you learn pretty quick that your mindset has to change when you start masters, you know. It becomes less about trying to get a HD. You know, you have to say goodbye to that really, really quickly. And you have, you know, the word it keeps coming to mind is adaptability. You know, you need to really, really change really quickly and go, okay, I've gone through two doors now. I'm opening another one, and I've been pushed through, and I need to sort of unlearn some of this stuff, start again with a fresh attitude, and an open mindset. And I saw some of my other, you know, fellow students, they struggle with that, and I struggled with it too, you know, in getting those results back, which weren't quite what you wanted. And then also having to prioritize, you sort of, I remember thinking after about week five, I thought, well, look, you know, I've got four units. I've got to consider getting ready for a placement and being a psychologist for the first time in the clinic. I've got to start thinking about a thesis. I don't have time to get HDs. So something has to give, and I need to prioritize what's really important for me. So the value then goes into getting an education, getting experience, and you start to think about, okay, I'm going to get what I can from these 2 or 3 years to be a better psychologist. So that's where my focus is. So there needs to be a shift. You need to be adaptable. And yeah, I did. You know, I really sort of used those years to read up on you know, different things. I got ready for how to do CBT therapy quite early. You know, I went out and bought Beck's book well in advance, and my focus completely changed.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing some of the habits that you put in place during the particularly, or whether they changed from honours to masters, how you approached it? I know that we all have a unique journey, but, you know, what was it that worked for you? Did you make some adjustments along the way? You know, what was hard? What was easy?
Okay. Good question. Look, here's a bit of a plug for James Clear. I recommend anyone doing the program to go out and buy Atomic Habits. It's a really wonderful book. But look, they were just sort of practical. So, you know, making sure that, you know, I'd shuffle around my room to make sure that there was a book to my left, my left bedside table. And I'd read that, was always there, so I'd be watching, looking at it all the time. So that would be that would sort of entice me to pick up the book and motivate me to read it on a daily basis. This would be things like setting your alarm at 6 o'clock, and that was really difficult for me because I'd always been a set the alarm for 8 a.m. usually, or 9 a.m. So getting up a little bit earlier, having that personal time where there's no one else around, there's nothing to distract you, and pouring yourself a cup of coffee, sitting down, preparing for today's class, preparing for today's session, rather than wait until you're at uni or wait until you're at the psychology clinic, because then it's too late. So just daily rituals like that I found really important. Another habit was sort of...
It's a preparation for you in terms of being able to feel grounded at the start of the day because you've done some prep that allows you to kind of then walk into the day, so to speak.
Absolutely. And it's sort of, it's a good way to kick anxiety or stress and fear. So wake up, have a daily habit whereby you read a chapter. It doesn't need to be much. Or just go through your notes, prepare. That's super important because you want to be going into sessions. You want to be going into class prepared and relaxed rather than frantic and, you know, and anxious. And it's super important when you're doing a thesis at the same time to get those really good study habits. And also there were habits in terms of well-being that included, you know, I didn't eat bad food for those 2 years much. So I was really conscious of my diet, what I was eating. It's pretty strict and hard on myself regarding that. And also regular exercise as well. You got to do as much as you can to make sure that you're in a good space mentally and relaxed, because you will be tested. You will be challenged.
Mm. And how did you approach, you know, difficult deadlines?
With stress. No, I guess
perfect answer. Frantically.
Absolutely. I suppose it's about getting on top of things a little bit earlier. You know, in the undergraduate degree, I suppose you could afford to do things the night before. You could afford to do things on the weekend and, you know, hand it in on Sunday night. But in masters, you can't afford to do that. There's too many things coming at you at once. And if you're going to do that, that's going to set you up for a bad day on the Monday. You won't be prepared for your classes, or you won't be prepared for your sessions. So you need to do things gradually and take time and hand things in early if possible.
Mm. So in some sense, more preparation to soften the amount of, you know, strain, tension, angst that comes with large pieces of work needing to be, you know, handed in or prepared for, you know, so that you can go out and continue on, not become overwhelmed.
Absolutely. Preparation is the key, and making sure that you do things early, tackle them early. As soon as they come in, you know, get started, you know, because you might find you'll have four assignments to do at once. You might have four sessions to prepare for, and you might have to have meetings with your supervisors and do some thesis work all at once. And then you might also have to work. So you may not have the opportunity to study in some of the times you're particularly usually more comfortable with. I used to enjoy studying at night, but I found that during my master's, I did a lot of work at night. So that meant that I had to get up early, make sure I had that time to study. Which, yeah, did a lot for my anxiety. You know, I think I would have been a lot more anxious had I'd continued to be the person I was an undergraduate. So.
It's so interesting to kind of look at it in this way where, you know, there's this almost adoption of anxiety that, you know, it's almost like, how do you get through without it? You know, there's this idea that we can kind of, you know, prep our way out of anxiety, or, you know, study our way and set up habits so that, you know, we go through smoothly is you know, complete nonsense and just doesn't occur for the absolute vast majority, if any. We go through and you know, we're kind of a scared and anxious and worried, and we compare ourselves with our cohorts, and, you know, we're nervous, and we, you know, our hands tremble when it comes time to doing the exam or seeing our first client in the clinic. I'm assuming as well for you if that's true, that we're often in somewhat panic stations. We're scared. There's a lot riding on it.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons to learn, you know, in the transition to from honours to, you know, the clinical program is just, I guess, if I had to reflect on my own thoughts and my own feelings, I guess I had sort of like an imposter syndrome, you know, and I was thinking, oh, hold on, what am I doing going helping someone with anxiety when I get anxious? And, you know, it's kind of like it's only through conversations with your supervisor where they'll say, you know, Glenn, everyone gets anxious. It's not just you. Did you not know that? And so I guess it's about knowing what's acceptable anxiety and when you've got a sort of an anxiety problem. So I was definitely very anxious to start. Yeah.
It's quite funny because this idea of acceptable, you know, anxiety, what's acceptable, what's expected, are going to be high levels of, you know, it's almost like the question of what are you going to do if you don't get into masters? You know, there could be another question of saying, how do you usually go when you're absolutely stressed out of your mind and you're panicking and then you hit with a, you know, a 5,000 word essay on top of that, and you've got no money for rent, and how are you going to go? You know, and because it is going to be, you know, there's going to be moments at least. You know, we don't want to paint the picture of, you know, it's all going to be awful. And my next question will be what you enjoyed most, you know, it's not all awful, but you've got to be able to go and live through those darker. Painful times.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that would probably be a pretty good question to ask, you know, someone and really gauge their coping style, you know, and how they go under pressure. And look, I suppose me being sort of in my late 20s, or when I was doing the master's program, I suppose I must have been sort of 33, 32, 33, 34. And I'd had a little bit more experience with dealing with pressure. You know, and I wasn't good at it. You know, none of us are experts at it. I found the master's experience just as challenging and stressful as everyone else. But I suppose I often thought and I often wondered, you know, if I was 23, if I was 23 years old doing this program now, how would I be? I don't know if I'd be any better or any worse. But I suppose it is really important to make sure that, you know, you do have good strategies for coping with stress and for being challenged, you know, because you're definitely going to be challenged. Mm. And for some people, they would have never been challenged like this before. And now I think about it, I don't think I've ever been really challenged like that before. It really was a challenge. But, I'm very thankful to have done it.
Yeah. What would you say you enjoyed most about, you know, master's, honours, you know, the uni experience and obviously doing something that you're passionate about?
Yeah, I enjoyed the reading. I just enjoyed the quiet reading. Making new friends is always good. But I just really found it fascinating. You know, picking up textbooks and connecting the dots and, oh, okay, that's how that works. And, oh, okay, great. Oh, I see now. And, you know, for years you've sort of wondered, you know, how does the mind work? You know, I'm curious. And then all of a sudden all those answers, are you getting all those answers? So I found that really, really awesome. Also, I really love the master's program and being able to work with clients for the first time. It was just like the biggest reward at the end of all of it. And those two things for me just made it all worthwhile, particularly working as a therapist for the first time, because it just felt like for four and a half years, you're like, okay, when do I get to do this? I know I'm a good therapist. I know I've got it in me. Just let me at them, you know, and you're finally given that opportunity, and it's just the best thing in the world. Really good.
It's so interesting to hear, because so many of us find that, you know, that reward of finally being able to do what we've always hoped for and wanted. It's kind of like almost like a peak moment, and at the same time, did the imposter come out at all, especially when there was a video in the room? I'm assuming there was a video in the room that you had to then show to your supervisor.
Yeah. What a way to make you feel relaxed, right? look, that was
Did I
stressful.
Say that right? You know, am I nodding correctly? Am I mirroring? What am I doing?
That's true. That's a really good point. And, you know, that can be a challenge at first, you know, particularly when you see yourself on camera for the first time as well. And it's like, wow, do I look, am I that bad? I didn't know I was doing that. You know, I'm saying a lot. Maybe I should tone the ums down. And, you know, I'm drifting off sometimes. My eyes are darting around the room, and I better stop that. But I guess it makes you really look at your behavior in a way that you've never looked at it before, you know. And there's a reason why, you know, all that sort of that Carl Rogers sort of building that sort of is so important, and that sort of, you know, that Egan and stuff, and learning those basic sort of counseling skills and active listening. And there's a reason why they focus so much on that, because it's just so crucial, you know, particularly when you first meet a client, and you need to really be able to build that rapport, build that trust, that empathy. And your active listening skills need to be really good, really sharp, because they're so powerful. But having said that, it was scary as hell at first, and having the video camera on you and meeting with your supervisor. And if you're a little bit sensitive to criticism, it's not the best experience for you. So you need to sort of, and I struggled with this probably the most, because I thought, oh, it's not that bad, you know, I'm not doing too bad, you know, my active listening skills are okay, and a little bit defensive at times, but it's a hell of a challenge to do that, you know, but it is worth it, but difficult.
Absolutely. How did you go with setting up your placements? I know that a lot of students, I get emailed almost on a weekly basis looking for a placement. You know, it's a fairly tight, I don't know what it's like in Newcastle, but it's a fairly tight, Sydney, because you're in Western Sydney. You know, it's a tight market, you know, in terms of trying to find some placements. How did that go? Was that something that the university was set up for you? Was that something that you went out and independently did? Did you have to be driven in that sort of way? How did you go about it?
Yeah, look, we were fortunate. UWS, Western Sydney University now, it's been rebranded. We were very fortunate in that we had a placement sort of supervisor or coordinator, and his role was to find us placements and suitable placements. And I must say, like, the entire process was pretty good. You know, they were pretty regularly checking in, making sure we're doing okay. You know, and we didn't go out to a placement where we weren't suited, I suppose you could say. There was a lot of emphasis on making sure that it was the right fit. So we were going to go out somewhere, and we were going to, you know, it's going to match our level of skill, our level of competence, and just where we were at, you know, and what we were comfortable with. So that was really important. The placements were great. You know, I learned so much from doing placements. You just sort of, you're sort of thrown out there, and you're just around. But not in the deep end. There's a lot of support, but you just all of a sudden you're around a group of professionals, and they've been doing it for some people have been doing it for 20, 30 years. And you might be in a multidisciplinary team. You might be working with occupational therapists, psychiatrists, clinical psychologists. Some people might do a placement. It might be sort of in a forensic setting, and you're learning at such an accelerated rate in that environment. It's just so invaluable. And I very rarely hear of people that, it does happen. I heard a few people that didn't have the best experience, but most of the feedback is, you know, we loved it. More of this, you know, please give us more. And certainly overall, my experiences and placement were just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. It lends itself to also another question, you know, in you noting how important it is to marry up one's level of experience and let's say competency as well, or exposure, if we can call it that, to what happens post graduation. So, you know, you go through your four placements and, you know, you tick those boxes, you know, your supervisor's happy with, you know, your competence across, you know, all the different, you know, areas, ethics and practice and, you know, working across the lifespan and so on and so forth. And then in some sense, you kind of, you know, you tick the box of the thesis, and then you kind of, you're given a license, right? You know, you're ticked off. APRA goes out and says, you know, you are now, you know, part of the team. You know, you can go out. How did you go about kind of finding a place that suits, you know, what you were hoping to get as an, you know, early career psychologist at that point?
That's a good question. I thought long and hard about this. You know, I applied for a lot of different positions. I think after handing in my thesis and taking a well-earned holiday, whilst on holiday, Fiji, by the way, it was wonderful.
Shout out to Fiji, of course.
Very relaxing place, a good place to go after anyone finishes
and
their
master's
degree.
Well deserved, yeah. Yes.
whilst I was over there, I really started thinking about this, you know, not too seriously, you know, it wasn't taking up too much of my time, but I started thinking, you know, where do I want to be and how do I want to, because it's 2 year, after you finish your degree, you've got to do a 2 year clinical psych registrar program, which is, you know, you've got a supervisor and you've got to do what you need to do to get registered to be a board approved clinical psychologist. So I thought, where do I want to spend the next 2 years and how do I want to spend it? Of course, you know, I was originally from Newcastle and I thought, you know, it might be a good place to go back to. I enjoy, you know, the beach, I enjoy surfing. There's plenty of things to do here. It's really relaxing. And I thought, look, I'd really like to do private practice. So that was quite dear to my heart. I really got a lot out of, you know, working in the university clinic, one-on-one with clients. And I thought that was a really good way to accelerate your learning as well. So I thought, look, I'm going to learn so much in a short space of time doing this. And, you know, that's really where I wanted to be. And I've been out now for 4 months and I've absolutely loved the experience. It's been incredible.
And you chose private practice because the exposure that you were looking for in terms of to kind of continue and develop on what you've, you know, got from university and applied there, you wanted to continue that journey and continue that building of skills. That was, for you, private practice was the place to go into.
Absolutely. You know, I sort of, a few of my other friends were, you know, they were saying things like, oh, I don't know if I can go into private practice yet. You know, it's going to be quite intense. You know, you might get 30 or 36 clients per week. I don't know if I can organize myself and it just seems too stressful. Where I was sort of thinking, great, 30 clients a week. Imagine how quickly I'm going to learn. Like I'm just going to, you know, get so competent so quickly. It's like repetition is just God. You know, it's so important. And it's been like that. You know, the first 3 weeks were a baptism by fire. It was very confronting. And it was like I had to really, you know, take my habits to the next level. And time management was really important. But I could do a whole podcast on that. It's just a wonderful experience for me. I really enjoy it. You know, you get your regular clients, and then they've got different presentations, and it's just so fascinating. And you're learning on the fly, and you got that motivator always there to push you, push you a little bit more. Okay, there's a client who comes in and they specifically ask for a male therapist who knows schema therapy. Right. Okay. I better enroll in a course. I better get a supervisor who's competent in schema therapy, and I better start getting ready. It's a really good motivator when you've got the clients coming in one after the other, and you really tidy up your CBT skills, and you really make sure that you're competent, because you can't afford to be. You've really got to be efficient.
I imagine, and I'm just putting some assumptions out there, I imagine to be able to do that, you have to go into a practice that looks after the administrative support, where someone's doing bookings, someone's doing payments, someone's doing rebookings, cancellations, following up GP referrals, bringing in some referrals, or the vast majority of that looks after the practice, and you come in and focus on practice. Is that how it's built?
Absolutely. And I don't know how I would go, perhaps one day in the future, I might want to set up my own practice. A little bit of a dream, but we'll see how we go. And I think that's going to be a difficult task. I think it would be really hard to then have to organize, all those things, calling up clients, making sure that they come to their sessions, making sure they fill in all the confidentiality sheets, and all the letters and reports, and just there's so much administrative stuff that comes along with, being a psychologist or running a practice. We have a great reception staff here, and they do all that, which just enables me then to do my session plan, get a formulation, and then just really focus in on the sessions. It's wonderful.
I don't think it can work any other way. We actually work to so hard to be able to work a psychologist so that we could practice. But there's nothing in the degree that goes out and says, this is how you go out and run a business, right? How do you go out and organize all the IT that supports that, or, how do you organize all the information that goes out to clients, or, the advertising side, or, how do you even write up a confidentiality agreement with, informed consent, and have you ticked all the boxes, and is it really informed or not? What are your protocols around, when a third party comes in and requests for notes or whatever it might be, is prior consent reasonable enough, or do we need to get, current consent as well? And there's an infinite number of things. What happens when the printer dies, or doesn't link up to the computer?
Which it does too often.
Yeah, that's right. How do you kind of see for yourself how long, and I know that's only early days, but how long do you feel it's going to take for you to really, try and take a bit of a guesstimate, find your feet, where you kind of go, I think I've got most of my practice down pat without having to do, as much, cognitive work in formulation, in making sure I maintain some perspective taking from other means or methods, where I kind of can come in and start doing more of a supervisory role, so to speak, because I've got that level of experience before, let's say, I jump out and do it on my own.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it's going to take me at least, two or three years. I'm really coming at the next 2 years. I still feel like I'm a student, and that's the mentality. Yeah. So I'm learning. I'm picking people's brains in the office. I'm enrolling in courses. Just trying to build my knowledge base up. In terms of CBT, it just seems like you can always get a bit better with CBT. It's just, to watch how to watch other colleagues and how they can do it, it's inspiring. And I thought, oh, well, I've really got CBT down packed. I'm great. and then you learn that you can do things a little bit better or a little bit differently or adjust it to meet certain clients' needs with certain disorders or whatnot. So I feel you're always learning. So the next 2-3 years, I'm just a student.
Yeah. And it's so I think valuable to look at the Becks, you know, of the world and the Ellis's, that when you start seeing how they do their, if I can call it, craft, it's very, very often humbling to kind of, you know, come back and say, what are some of those maybe Rogerian things that I'm missing, I'm slipping away from, I'm you know, losing again. And so there's this constant dance to feel really competent and confident. I think it's not easy, and it takes, I think you're probably right, it takes a good, you know, three or so years to make sure all the joints are, you know, greased up and you know, it's functioning more loosely rather than mechanically. So, you know, I'd probably agree with that as well.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. And, you know, there's kind of the temptation to sort of, when you're finally given a license, you know, after 6 years of hard work and, you know, being put under the microscope, there's kind of a part of you which just wants to, there was a little part of me which thought, oh, I'm great, you know, I'm wonderful, I'm ready for this, you know, but that lasted about a day, which is a good thing. And then, you know, I think it is really important to humble yourself in the beginning and really learn from people. You know, what we've done in the degree, it's something to be proud of, and it's by no means something small. You know, it's something very significant, but the learning really just starts once you finish. You know, and you're going to learn so much from your colleagues. You're going to learn so much from, you know, the Becks and doing, you know, training and going on weekend training courses and stuff like that. That it's just going to be so invaluable. So staying humble, super important, And yeah, eventually the mechanics of what you're doing will just sort of fall into place, and it won't be so scripted. You know, you'll be able to come in, you'll feel more confident, and you know, you said competent, so you'll just be able to come in, know what you're doing, do things more fluidly and more naturally. Mm. You know.
Can you talk a little bit about how the experience has been over, I think you said, four months you've been practicing, post obviously uni. How have you found these last 4 months?
Really good. You know, first of all, it's wonderful to be working again. You know, the last time I had a full-time job, I was 28. So it's been a long time, and you know, you can't undervalue that. Like it's so important to have that income coming in, which is predictable, and you can plan your life again. You know, you can start planning for a future. So that's been wonderful. You know, it's just such a great feeling. In terms of my experiences in private practice, they've been exceptional. You know, they've exceeded my expectations. I've been involved in a lot of different stuff I didn't think I'd be involved in. So I've been given a lot of opportunities, you know, talking on a podcast, for instance, is one. but I've enjoyed, you know, doing training. I've been involved in the EAP program. So one of the things I've done is gone and spoken to minors in the Hunter Valley and just told them about, you know, mental health, well-being, given them some information about the EAP program, which has been really rewarding. But yeah, it has been an adjustment, and it's one that I'm just starting to sort of I feel I'm just coming through this, you know, through the initial stages now with a bit more confidence. So.
Mm. And in terms of sort of that transitioning the sort of university life to back to a full-time sort of employee life, what's that been like, post all the hard work and, you know, giving up weekends and so on, that, you know, you kind of get, I imagine, get to go back to your personal life again, you know, with more hours to provide to it?
Oh, it's bliss. It's absolute bliss.
There's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, there is. I think for the first few weeks, you know, I was sort of still caught up in, you know, I just sort of in the back of my mind, I was so used to there being something to do, you know. You've got to do this at 7 o'clock. You've got to meet with your supervisor. There was always, during the master's program, there was always something in the back of your mind that needed to be done, should be done. And I suppose that there was still that sort of niggling voice there for the first few weeks or first month. And I had to sort of tell myself, hey, look, it's all good. You can go to the beach. You can go and watch a footy game. You can have a beer, you know, like you're allowed to relax.
Without guilt? That's crazy.
I know, right? Took a while, but it's just a really good feeling not to have to worry about those things, you know, and I guess fantastic feeling. There is that light at the end of the tunnel. So.
Any challenges you'd know to have been difficult you've had to wrestle with?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's like the new environment. So I've never really been in an office environment before. And also you have to be really, really well organized, you know, and I suppose I'd got better at doing that throughout the program, but, you know, just the level of accountability is really a bit of a shock as well. It's like, oh wow, I'm not Glenn the student anymore. I'm not a provisionally registered psychologist. I'm not affiliated with the university anymore. I'm a professional now and I'm accountable. So it's about, you know, being accountable. That was a bit of a challenge and a bit of a shock initially. I was like, oh goodness, I've got to make sure that I get all my documentation done. And there's no supervisor there checking up on you saying, oh, Glenn, you know, you didn't do your progress notes or they weren't done properly. So you've got to take that responsibility on board then. So that was an initial shock and challenge. And I feel that's pretty normal, though. I imagine most people would go through something like that. And also the office life, as I was saying. So just, you know, relationships are very important in an office. So making sure you've got a really good relationship with the secretaries and office staff, the other colleagues, and also having something to say in group supervision as well. So, yeah, those are probably the two main challenges for me, sort of accountability and making sure that, you know, you do the right things by your secretaries and you build up good relationships with other staff members.
I'll tell you what the secretaries are the absolute lifeblood, right? Without them and a really strong practice manager, and when I say strong, meaning, you know, well organized, very thorough, can kind of juggle many balls at the same time. You know, without them, the practice just doesn't go out and work. And that's probably what you alluded to previously in terms of, you know, what it would be like to try and run the whole show yourself while also trying to continue with your clinical, experience and progress. It's a lot of balls to try and keep in the air.
Absolutely.
So treat your secretaries and practice managers exceptionally well. It's kind of like in the army, the most powerful person is known as the chef, right? The cook. If you get them offside, you're in trouble.
That's true. That's a good point. So look, I think it's the little things that you learn really quickly, like saying thank you, you know, and just genuinely showing, being appreciative for all their work. And, you know, I was lucky. I've had you know, a little bit of experience with that sort of role. So you really get an appreciation for what they do, and they do a lot of work. And I don't think people can really appreciate how much work they do. They work very hard, and, you know, their jobs are stressful too. And they're doing all this wonderful stuff for us. So, you know, just saying thank you, you know, I appreciate you doing that. Thanks for sending that email. Thanks for sending out that letter. Thanks for drafting that for me. It goes a long way, you know. And, you know, that's something that if you're not new to an office environment, you might not think to do those sort of things. But these are things that all come back, you know, and, you know, they reflect on you. So just making sure that, you know, being aware that you're representing yourself and trying to, you know, make sure that you've got good relationships with all staff members is vital.
Absolutely. Would you do anything different in your degree and in your transition now into private practice that you can think of? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, there are. There's a few. It's quite a list. I'll pick a few. I think in the early days I was really quite introverted, and I was quite results driven, you know, and that you know, a lot of psychologists are guilty of that. So and you had to be.
I'll tell you what, it's so painful, isn't it? You're results driven, and then a client sort of situation, you know, doesn't go favorably, and you just take it all on yourself. It just hurts. You're like, what am I doing wrong here? You know, I didn't try hard enough here. I should have done more there. I could have called him. You know, yeah. It just resonated so much that I remember doing all sorts of things on weekends to you know, prepare and, you know, assist clients, you know, for when I get back on, you know, Monday, I'm going to go in with, you know, all the latest and all the best and so on and so forth, you know, only to go out and, you know, be hurt again.
Yeah, that's a good point. Look, that resonates with me. Okay, yeah. So that's true. And it is, you know, we set the bar so high, you know, we are, yeah, I'm not speaking for every psychologist or every professional, but overall, look, it's probably fair to say some people can be quite perfectionistic, okay, and quite results driven. And, you know, it's about just sort of loosening that a little bit, you know, and gradually loosening that. And you hit on a good point, you know, you might spend the weekend studying up, planning, you know, the sessions and thinking, oh, I'm going to try this session and it's just going to be wonderful. And, you know, clients are going to go, thank you, you know, this is really great, and we're going to feel so good about ourselves. And then in walks the client, and they've had a really bad week or something's come up, and a lot of that stuff can go out the window. So we have to sort of adjust really quickly and then, you know, focus on the client, which is where we should be. So it can leave us, our egos a little bit bruised. We think, oh, wow, I've done all this work, you know, I had all these expectations, and now here we go. But we're doing our job, you know, and we have to just sort of make sure that we adjust go back to those. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that's such a common experience in the health caring industries. You know, it's our love of people that brings us towards this, and because we love and we care so much, we therefore invest so much. And when you invest so much into the outcome, you inevitably get hurt, and you get hurt a lot. And part of our, you know, part of our work is to you know, be able to detach somewhat, you know, to at least to the outcome, and rather be objective, because the closer we are to the outcome, the more we get invested in how things should be, which isn't the role of a psychologist. So it's quite funny. There's that tension in the therapy room, not only between, you know, the client desiring, urging something wise from the psychologist, but also the psychologist not providing that, you know, kind of stepping back, because, you know, we desire to tell our children the answer, and in doing so we create dependency, or they don't learn it. It doesn't kind of it doesn't go in deep. It's not an emotionally encoded understanding. It becomes it just becomes another piece of knowledge.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, I suppose we can fall into that trap, you know, and I do enjoy teaching, you know, so I just love sort of talking, you probably guessed. So I like to talk to people and I really like to tell them what I know, you know, and in the early days, and I'm still in the early days, but, you know, in the first sort of month when I started, there was just that I was constantly just at odds with this desire just to tell people all the, you know, CBT principles and, you know, sort of didactically, just sort of, you know, rather than Socratically. So I suppose, and I still wrestle with that, you know, I feel that, you know, I'm going into teacher mode here and there's a time for that, you know, and it's usually clients will ask you, they'll say, oh, can you explain this principle to me, or can you explain how the emotional system works, or something like that. And then you can launch in and you go, well, I never thought you'd ask. Great. So you can, you know, get stuck into it. But yeah, there is constantly that battle, you know, what is my role here? And you're constantly asking yourself that question. What am I doing here? What do I want out of this? Who am I here for? You keep going back to those sort of Carl Rogers sort of Rogerian principles, you know, and more often than not, you know, when you come back to those, things end up going good. But yeah, constantly
wanting. It's almost like they actually put the bait out. I've been playing with my practice really kind of hard in the last few months. Again, you know, you kind of tend to do that all the time. The bait of the client asking the clinician, you know, it's such an easy one to take versus the Carl Rogers, you know, approach might be, how do you think it works? Which kind of, it's really hard. I've been playing with this idea about not providing psychoed anymore, and quite firmly holding it. And it's fascinating where a session goes without psychoed, which, you know, psychologists love, because it tends to explain things, but explains, I'm not quite convinced. I'm wrestling, playing. It's always fascinating to look at this, but, you know, we could do a whole 10 podcasts on this. it's fascinating to keep looking at our practice, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that sort of self-reflection, which is so important, you know. And, you know, I'm interested by, you know, by your strategy, you know, like not providing psychoed. And, you know, I guess it's sort of like, you know, I guess it's there when the clients sort of ask for it. You know, it's good sort of to fall back on and say, oh, you know, great, you know, I'll tell you about CBT, or I'll give you some information about anxiety or depression or OCD. But yeah, I guess it's never really where we should lead, you know, and it gets back to what is our role? You know, am I a university lecturer here or am I a psychologist, you know? And it's about, you know, helping, like, you know, like Carl Rogers would do, or, you know, you know, that Socratic dialogue, questioning, or that sort of that style of doing things is sort of, you know, asking questions that the client can answer, you know, and
staying curious. You know, I think I don't know what's right. You know, I feel like I'm more of a novice than I've ever been, and I hope I know even less in 10 years' time, because the more I work in this field, certainly I feel like I know a whole lot less. There's so much that I would have previously rejected, and I just don't have my experience tells me that I'm wrong all the time, and it keeps us curious. So it's an exciting sort of space, and you know, it sounds like you're doing very much that, you know, in keeping up with that curiosity and playing with it as you go, you know, certainly I think helps to make for, you know, a good clinician that's going to continue, you know, asking these harder questions. You know, why are we doing this? Or why are we doing that? Why am I choosing these words? You know, there's a lot to be said about, you know, relational frame theory and you know, other perspectives, you know. As a clinician, keep curious, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Yeah.
So people might want to know how they can find out more about you, where they can maybe make contact with you, how they might even go out and you know, seek your services. How can people find out more?
Currently, I work at New Psych Psychologist, so that's at in Newcastle. So that's one way to contact me. I'm on LinkedIn as well. So those are probably the two best ways at the moment for now.
Fantastic. And any last parting words you would like to share, particularly for those who are going through the process of, you know, still in their studies, trying to, you know, get through, or those who are in their early days and you know, in a similar sort of space as to, you know, what they should potentially, you know, be looking for in these next, you know, 3 to 5 years of their practice?
Oh, yeah, sure. For anyone still doing the program, self-care, you know, self-care is God. You know, make sure you're looking after yourself, making sure you're getting into regular routines, make life easier on yourself. You know, if you can get into support from, you know, a partner, from family members, take it, you know, and if anyone ever offers you help, don't say no.
Yeah, lovely. And to those who are in similar shoes as yourself, obviously doesn't need to be the most formulated and the gold piece of advice, but, you know, where do you think the next, you know, 3 to 5 years lies for everyone in these shoes, you know, generally?
Yeah. Look, I encourage people in similar situation to me to challenge yourself. You know, and look, we're at an exciting time being a psychologist, particularly in Australia with what's happening. It's an exciting time to be alive, and it's an exciting time to be a psychologist in general. I think, you know, just challenge yourself, you know, be kind to yourself as well, but always challenge yourself, you know, whether that be learning new theories, expanding your repertoire of knowledge, and then just trying to make sure that you're a better therapist, or working towards becoming a good therapist. You know, you don't have to be the best, but, you know, it's like what Abraham Lincoln said, you know, whatever you are, just be a good one. So just make sure that, you know, you're working towards that.
Lovely. I think well said, you know, particularly in these earlier years, and I would probably, you know, echo that in later years as well. So, Glenn, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I wish you all the absolute very best in your you know, career, and big congratulations with your recent you know, achievements. And I'm sure we'll go out and touch base at a later date, cross paths. You know, the psychology world here in Australia is very, very tight, and yeah, look forward to catching up and having a good old gas bag again sometime.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on the show.